Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Mark David. Mark David is the founder and director of the Institute for the Psychology of Eating, and he's the author of two best-selling books, The Slow Down Diet and Nourishing Wisdom. Mark's humorous, engaging, and informative style appeals to a wide audience of eaters who are looking for positive, inspiring, and innovative messages about food and about metabolism. Mark has presented at Harvard University, the National Institute for the Clinical Application of Behavioral Medicine, and on many national television programs. His warmth is contagious, and his message is helping millions to reclaim a relationship with food that truly nourishes body and spirit. So now, Mark, my dad and I are so grateful for your work, for your message, for the love that just exudes through what you do. And for this interview, I'm going to hand it over now to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Mark, for being with us.
I feel honored to be here, by the way, so thank you.
Well, we're honored to have you, and I'm really glad to bring your voice and your wisdom and your message and insights to our listeners, who I know will appreciate them. One of the things that stands out to me about your work is that most writers who focus on food issues are primarily concerned with the nutrient value and the health benefits of the various foods and the various dietary regimens. But I hear you wanting to bring our attention not just to the food we eat, but really to our relationship with that food. Is this because our mood and our stress levels when we eat have an impact on our digestion and metabolism and thus on our weight and on our health?
Thank you for asking that question, and I would say in a huge way. We have, and when I say we, I'm thinking the field of nutrition and all the experts that have a passion for this topic. We look at the food, and we have to. We have to look at the nutrient content of the food. And at the same time, what I like to say is that really judging the true worth of a food by its nutrient content alone is sort of like looking at a great work of art and trying to assess it by analyzing the pigments of the paint. You know, we have to look at the whole picture. We have to look at the whole gestalt. And part of that is, what about the body that's over here receiving that food? Because I think we know, if you and I are in a conversation, and if one of us is not listening, information's not going to be absorbed. The connection's not going to happen. There won't be a flow back and forth of love or wisdom because I'm not receiving from my end. I'm not hearing. My mind is elsewhere. Well, literally and physiologically, that is how the body works. When we are in any kind of anxiety, fear, anger, stress, the body will instantaneously drop into some degree of physiologic stress response, which translates to heart rate up, blood pressure up. But it's the survival response, this evolutionary mechanism that's been built into our system, such that indeed when my life is being threatened, when the brain perceives stress, and the scientific definition of stress, by the way, is any real or imagined threat. So it doesn't have to be a real threat. Brain perceives any kind of threat, we go into stress response, and in a full-blown stress response, when the lion is chasing you, digestion and assimilation completely shuts down. Because in those moments when you're fighting that lion for your life or you're fleeing, you don't want to have all your metabolic energy being wasted digesting your Fruit Loops. You want all your energy going into survival. So if we're sitting down to a meal and there is any kind of upset, any kind of fear, tension, anxiety in the system, the body registers that as a stressor. We will create stress chemistry and go into some degree again of digestive shutdown, which in essence means nutrient excretion, and will translate into oftentimes digestive symptoms, digestive upset. And when it's chronic, everyday, low-level stress that, quite frankly, if you're alive on planet Earth today, it's not so easy to live the nice, easy, relaxed style of living because we have a lot to contend with. So it feels like we live in a time when we have to slow down a bit, when we have to check in with ourselves and see, am I in the right optimum state to absorb my food and absorb everything that's going on around me?
I hear you saying two things. I'm going to check this out, see if I'm hearing you accurately. One is that by eating more slowly and more attentively, our digestion improves and we enjoy our food more, which gives us more satisfaction. And this, in turn, probably makes us less likely to overeat or eat foods that are bad for us. And it makes us more able to digest and metabolize our food because we're not in the anxiety stress response. So we're more relaxed and more receptive to the food. So that's one thing I'm hearing. And then I'm also hearing that you said, if you and I are talking and I'm not listening to you, my head is somewhere else, I'm in some way disconnected, I don't receive the information you're giving me. Are you saying, by analogy then, that if we don't taste our food, really taste it, if we don't listen to the food experience that we're having, if we're not present, we don't absorb the nutrients, we don't receive the information, we don't actually experience the nourishment that the food would otherwise provide us?
In a big way, yes. So to the second point, we will literally be excreting nutrition. We can take test subjects who are nice and relaxed and take a urine sample, and you'll have a small amount of minerals being excreted, mostly some of the more macro minerals like calcium, magnesium, phosphorus. As soon as you put that person under stress, then you take a mineral sample from their urine, you will find copious amounts of calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, and all the micro minerals, zinc, selenium. So quite literally, when we are not in that optimum state of digestion and assimilation, which happens to be relaxation or the physiologic relaxation response, yes, we will literally excrete nutrients. And we've known this since the 1930s, for goodness sakes. And to your first point, when we're in that stress chemistry, that fear, that anxiety, appetite is deregulated. Because when you and I are in that stress response, the brain ceases to scan the meal for nutrient profile. The brain is not interested in taste and pleasure and aroma and satisfaction. Quite the opposite, the brain is interested in registering pain. Because when we're in a fight or flight situation, we want to know, God, am I cut? Am I okay? Am I damaged? So we are literally, physiologically, chemically desensitized to pleasure and essentially then nourishment and feeling good and appetite. As you mentioned, eating fast is considered by the body a stressor. So humans are not designed to eat really quickly. Body will consider that a stressor and will go into some degree of localized digestive shutdown. Cortisol is one of the hormones that we will produce in the stress response. Cortisol by itself desensitizes the body to pleasure. So then what happens is, you know, a lot of people come to the meal and go, oh my God, I shouldn't eat this. It's fattening. It's no good for me. It's going to make me gain weight. And then I'm under stress and I'm going to produce cortisol and it desensitizes me to pleasure. And because we're human beings and we're designed to seek pleasure and avoid pain, I won't be getting the pleasure I'm seeking from that meal because of stress chemistry, cortisol. And therefore, I will need to eat more, which becomes what I like to call a self-fulfilling metabolic prophecy. But again, it's all triggered so often by this thing called fear, stress, not being present, moving too fast.
When I think of the stress that a lot of us bring to our meals, I mean, all of us carry a great deal of baggage when it comes to body image issues and our weight. Our society particularly polices women's bodies and is always commenting about how they look. And men, too, have this, perhaps to a lesser degree. But we all can be pretty critical about how we look and also about what we do or don't eat. There's a lot of shoulds and shouldn'ts, a lot of rules. All this creates stress. And we carry fears, guilt, old habits with us to the table. But if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that we have to somehow relax ourselves, be witness to that, and yet release that in some way in order to have a truly nurturing experience of eating.
Bingo. And to me, what you just so beautifully put, and I'm going to just say it in different words, is that our relationship with food can then become a teacher for us, and a great teacher. And I say great teacher with a capital G and a capital T, because it's so true. We do bring so much history and baggage, and it's not just us personally. We inherit it from the world. We inherit it from culture and from media, and we're getting these messages that are toxic to the human mind and the human soul, and they're like little viruses inside of us. You're no good, you're too fat, you're too this, you're too that, and whatever your parents told you or didn't tell you. And yes, we can do work on self. Yes, I can do counseling or coaching and therapy, and that's great. And there's this beautiful way that healing and transformation happens in the now. So when I come to a meal, can I drop into breathing and relaxation? Can I slow down? Can I become more present? Can I take in sensations? Can I appreciate my food? Can I start to connect with the meal in front of me and wonder, oh, where did this come from? Thank you for cooking it. Where was it grown? Is this okay? When we engage with our relationship with food as if it is a teacher, then all of a sudden we can learn so much about ourselves and indeed bring ourselves into the now so we can get current and contemporary. And as I said, simple practices, breathing, gratitude, relaxing in any way you can, and breathing 5 to 10 long, slow, deep breaths with a meal will literally take most human beings from stress chemistry to relaxation chemistry in about less than a minute. So we have a powerful way to really begin to transform ourselves.
When you sit down to eat, if you're carrying some degree of stress, as you mentioned, in this society, in these times, we have a great deal to contend with. Most of us have time stress, so we're in a hurry, we rush, and you sit down to eat. What do you do yourself to calm, soothe, center, prepare yourself for the food in a way? You know, we talk about preparing food for us. We always talk about how the food's prepared. But what I'm hearing you talk about is we prepare ourselves for the engagement, the encounter of nourishment. So what do you do?
What I do, generally speaking, is I check in with myself. And I ask myself, where am I? I will use the meal as a way to get present. It's almost like the meal for me is this little bell that rings. Because I think a lot of us, for me, you know, oftentimes we teach what we need to learn. So left to my own device, I would probably be a fast, unconscious eater. But because I teach this stuff, I'd probably better practice it. So I will look at my food because I find food fascinating. So just tuning into sensations, I really want to notice it. And because I think food is beautiful and because I appreciate it, I will take in the colors and I will take in the beauty and I will notice the sensations. And that could just be 5 or 6 seconds. It could be 15 seconds. But that pause helps me drop in. Especially if I'm eating with someone else, I might focus on the other person for a moment. Thank you for sitting down to this meal with me. If I'm with the kind of person or crowd that likes to do a prayer or a blessing, I'll do that. If I'm by myself eating and I'm in my intense, stressful work day, I will definitely have to close my eyes and take a few breaths, because for me, if I don't, I will just whip through my meal so I can get back to work. So the food becomes a reminder for me. So breathing or taking in the sensations, or really dropping in with the person next to me. And gratitude. gratitude for me is probably the big home run that I can do, because it just seems to wash over me in a bigger way, and it's more than about the food. You know, if I drop into gratitude, it feels bigger than just a meal.
I'm hearing you talk about eating at its deepest level as a relationship with life. It's a form of love. It's an affirmation of our essential humanity and our connection to the earth that gives us our food.
Mm. You know, John, in my universe of eating psychology, you'll often hear people maybe in the eating disorder universe will say, well, gosh, you know, people are using food as love. And they're turning to food as love, and that's why they have these eating challenges and these eating issues. And, yeah, a lot of people, I might not have the love in my life or the connection or the intimacy or the family, or I'm lonely. So we will naturally turn to food for love. But let me explain why I think that's true. Because at the fundamental level, food is love. So you and I were gestated in mama's womb, and we had a cord coming into our belly, and we're being carried as this tiny, helpless thing. That's love. You know, you pop out of the womb, and you're being breastfed and held and touched and sung to. And to an infant's experience, to an infant's nervous system, it's all one. An infant, Freud called this polymorphously perverse, and an infant cannot distinguish between separate sensations. This is the food in my mouth. This is the taste. This is my mother singing. This is her warmth. This is her touch. It's all experienced as one, and it's encoded as cellular memory that food is love. And it's a gift. It's the manna from heaven. So what happens is, to me, on one level, if we sort of bump this up to something that I know you embrace very well and look at the entire food chain, and we look at the planet, and we look at what we're doing with food. If I can do one simple diagnosis of what's going wrong with the whole food chain and the challenges that we're having, you know, as individuals and as a planet, is we've removed, in a lot of ways, love from food. Because if we put love into food at every step of the game, then how it was grown would be beautiful. The people who were growing it would be taken care of, and they'd be happy. There would not be harmful substances deliberately or foolishly put into the food, because that wouldn't be loving. We wouldn't produce cheap food just to make a profit. We wouldn't come into other, you know, countries all over the world and take their resources. That wouldn't be very loving. If love was put into every step of the equation, it would transform in a moment. So at the very least, it's seemingly easiest to work in the comfort of my own skin and begin to notice where I attack self, where we go into the self-attack around just the mind can be crazy and torture us with judgments. So, you know, as we work on that, it might become a little bit easier to then expand that understanding out and look at those around us who are in pain, and then look at the food chain. And as we feel more nourished and more self-empowered, then there's more energy to say, wait a second, how do we become better stewards of the earth and of the planet and of the food chain? And what would putting love and consciousness into the food chain mean? Because I think on a certain level, that's what we're facing. And love is often, I don't know if it's a dirty word so much as it's not so scientific, but I think it's a lot of the answer here.
I know for me, trying to bring love into my relationship with food has meant, for one thing, not eating meat or any animal products that are produced from factory farms, because the level of cruelty to the animals that's inherent in those production systems is just totally incompatible. It's totally incongruous with love, as I understand it and as I want to live it, because I do include animals in my circle of compassion and concern. And I also, any food that comes from a tropical country, coffee, chocolate, I always get fair trade if I can. And I get organic when I can, and it's not just to spare my body residues of the pesticides, that's important, but I'm also thinking about the farm workers, and if there's pesticides used in the production of the food, it's the farm workers who are most exposed to those sprays and those toxins. And I know about the inequities economically worldwide, and I know how coffee growers are treated and bananas and cocoa, perhaps worst of all, by the multinationals who really are thinking only about profit and squeezing their supply chains to the maximum they can. So by buying fair trade, I'm taking into account the well-being of the person who grew the food I'm, or the coffee or the chocolate that I'm eating. That's important to me.
Well, in my way of thinking, you're expanding the definition of love. Because somebody else might sit down to the table and their definition of love in that moment might be, you know, I just have to love myself and be okay with just eating food. There's some people who just, they're seeing food as the enemy because they've been taught that, you know, food is going to equal fat on my body. And they live in a lot of suffering and misery because of that. And it's a huge leap for them to just have a little self-love at the table. You know, you found a way to make that love bigger and bigger. And it's interesting because as you were just talking, you were very clear and specific about, hey, here's what I'm aware of, that if we use the food chain as a teacher, here's what I'm aware of that's going on in the food chain. And to me, that's making our love bigger and with less conditions. Because if there's less conditions on my love, I'm not looking to take advantage just so I can get a cheaper price or a cheaper food, whatever it is. So we're expanding our love. And it also, to me, helps take this a little bit out of the realm. I think when we start to talk about food, so many of the experts, they're disagreeing with each other. And we argue about science, and that's fine, because we have to oftentimes get on the same page about science and about technology. But I believe if we're being guided by love, the mind is able to make better decisions. The mind can see more clearly. And my experience of you is that you lead with your heart in that way, and we can make decisions that are more wise and, I believe, have a bigger impact as well.
Yeah, I think that part of the sickness of our culture is that we think too much with our brains and not enough with our hearts, and we respond too much to life and challenges and people and events from our calculating mind, our manipulative mind, and perhaps our exploitive mind, rather than from our capacity to engage at the heart, at the soul, at the level where reciprocal flow of energy is actually most nurturing to us. Earlier, you mentioned babies. And how they don't distinguish, and how the taste of mother's milk in their mouth really is the taste of love from their mother. I thought of how a lot of us weren't breastfed, and how, in fact, we were fed formula that was not created. It was really more concocted, manufactured. Certainly there's the effort to provide infants with the needed nutrients. But it's a commercial product.
Mm.
It's sold for profit. It's marketed in ways. I mean, sometimes in the third world, the marketing of formula is actually a criminal because they coax women away from breastfeeding and make it sound as though the woman's breast milk was inferior and she really needs to buy this product to nurture her baby properly. And yet we know the overwhelming evidence is overwhelming that breast milk is healthier. But I'm thinking about how if a person wasn't breastfed or if in some other way their relationship to food has become troubled, that they don't experience it as love, there's so much stress in the relationship that they have with food, then it would seem to me that the person's relationship with food is going to mirror their relationship to life, that how a person digests food will in some ways reflect the way they digest their other life experiences.
Mm. So beautifully put. I can certainly embellish on that. I believe, and this is not my idea, there's been plenty of brilliant minds who have been trying to get this understanding across for so many decades, that our first experiences in life, birth, even before birth, just gestation and birth, these are powerful experiences that set in motion our journey. And if you want to understand any aspect of our destination, it's always good to look at how we begin things. Psychologists know that, or certain psychologists truly understand, and there's a term in psychology, imprint vulnerability. And it simply states that there's different phases of life where we are very vulnerable to new imprinting, to new ideas, to new understanding. We are extremely imprint vulnerable right around the age of 13 when puberty starts to happen. We're imprint vulnerable around 21. We are very imprint vulnerable to certain new energies around age 7. And big time, we are imprint vulnerable when we pop out of that womb. And everything that happens, to your point, has a power that will last into life. So essentially I'm saying yes, in a big way, if we go against nature from the moment you pop out as a tiny helpless infant and feed the body a strange concoction of chemicals as a substitute for mother's milk, it distorts the system, it distorts reality, it distorts the wisdom of evolution, and that distortion will then build into every life stage. So it may very well be true that so many of our challenges with this thing we call eating disorders or overeating or binge eating or emotional issues with food can have a connection to our very early life experience, as you're saying, of not being breastfed, not being held, given a toxic infant formula that might be highly allergic to your system, and all of a sudden your first experience of nourishment coming into your body is your body has to go into an immune response against it to save yourself as this tiny helpless infant, and that will be imprinted as a memory. Food equals immune response. Food equals challenge. Food equals bad somehow. And we will take that again and reproduce it. So I want to say the good news in this is that we can turn that around. And one of the ways we can turn that around is beginning to understand how to put nourishing food in our bodies, beginning to understand how to create relaxation and love, because healing is always possible. Will we be perfect? No, everybody dies. But as we bring love and consciousness and awareness and knowledge and information into the present moment, we can definitely shift.
Have you found it helpful to reflect on the messages that you personally and your clients and people you counsel received from your parents, from your family about food? I'm thinking about a typical dinner in my household growing up in my family of origin. The level of stress was pretty intense. The relationships, the human relationships were not loving. There was a lot of competition for everything. And I think some of that can echo into our adult lives. Even if we would like to disabuse ourselves of those patterns, even if we see they don't serve us and they're counterproductive, we still can be attached to them at levels that are very profound because they insinuate deeply, as you put it, at an imprint vulnerability.
So to my mind, yes, absolutely. I call these beliefs or thoughts that you're mentioning, these imprints that land in us, they will often land as simple equations. So for you, it might have been food is a stressful experience. You might not have imprinted in your mind, well, eating with my parents and eating with my family, yeah, on some level that gets imprinted, but the psyche loves simple images and formulas. Food is a stressful experience. Food is competitive. I have to get mine. There's not enough to go around. Food and love don't come together. So I call these toxic nutritional beliefs or toxic nutritional thoughts. And they are...
I'm thinking about, when you mentioned toxic nutritional thoughts, how in our society, very often, sweets, candy is given to children, birthday cakes, ice cream. In my family of origin, ice cream played a huge role, where these high-sugar foods are identified with or are associated very deeply with celebration or reward or relaxation. And so then if we want to treat ourselves, if we want to be good to ourselves, we often by virtue of those associations and their imprint in us, will go to high sugar foods.
Mm. That's a very powerful imprinting. Food as reward is easily one of the most common imprints that a majority of us receive. You know, I'm a good girl, I'm a good boy, let me get the food, let me get the sugar, let me get whatever we've associated. For a lot of people, it's sugar. For a lot of people, it's also substances, foods that have a nice combination of fat and sugar. So ice cream, you know, good mixture of that sugar and fat sensation that is a very powerful neurochemical groove in the body. It's a very powerful chemical reward. And to me, to your point, it's about self-examination and self-awareness, because evolution is exciting and it's interesting. We are still evolving. We're evolving physically, emotionally, personally, spiritually, and we as humans have a very unique opportunity to participate in a wakeful way, in a deliberate way, in our own evolution. One of the ways we participate in our own evolution is to sometimes look at where evolution had a few little glitches in it and make a few course corrections and slowly follow and turn the ship so we are following our soul's compass and the compass of wisdom more and more, because that's going to take us into our full potential.
When you talk about following your soul's compass, I love that phrase. I'm hearing you say that the feelings we have about ourselves and our lives, and perhaps particularly at the very time we eat, have something to do then with how we metabolize our food and whether it builds health and happiness for us or leads to illness and stress and misery.
Mm. I think in a big way, you know, one way to frame different words around that is, what's my reason for eating even the good foods that I eat? One could be eating what you and I might agree is some of the healthiest food we could find. But if that healthy food is eaten out of, oh my God, fear of disease or fear of getting fat or fear of getting sick or fear that I'm going to die too early, we're living from that place of fear, then that's what we're multiplying into the system. And that's the chemistry we're creating, and that will impact digestion, assimilation, and calorie burning and health in a big way. If I'm eating healthy food because I'm inspired about it, because this feels good, this feels right, this feels like I'm adhering to the hidden architecture of the universe, to my soul's code that says this feels right, not just for me, but for the world. There's an inspiration that's born from that. And when we're inspired, we're expanded, we're uplifted, and science doesn't yet have a good chemical language to say, yes, here's the chemistry that's going on in your body when you're in upliftment or when you're in inspiration or when you're in love. I mean, we have some rudimentary understandings. We know way more about stress chemistry than we do about happiness chemistry, but it impacts the body. I have a formula that I love to use that I think helps really shine the magnifying glass on this, and it's personal power equals metabolic power. Personal power equals metabolic power. And what I mean by that is that as we become the best possible versions of who we're meant to be, and I'm not saying personal power from like you're a big tough ego guy. I'm saying when we follow our soul's code, the blueprint that's inside of us, because I believe we all have a beautiful blueprint to become this mighty oak tree. When we become the best possible version of who we're meant to be, the body then has the best chance to become the best possible version of what it can be. How could body and mind not follow one another? It's all connected. So my metabolism, my physiology has the best chance to find its fullest expression when I, as a human being, push the pedal to the metal a little more on asking the question, how do I become the best possible me? What does that even mean? How do I become the best possible me in my work, in my service to the world, in the gifts that I give, in my relationship, in how I sit down to the table, and in how I eat, and how I relate with the world? When we focus our attention on that, the body will begin to come into alignment. We will naturally start to gravitate towards food and towards an understanding of food that's probably right, that's more correct, that's more in alignment with our naturalness.
Mark, I so appreciate the wisdom that you're bringing here. It feels spiritual. It feels like what you're talking about are principles of spiritual living, of living on a spiritual path, walking a spiritual path through life, and attuning your life purpose with your daily life and your actions and the food you eat. And I don't hear you denying the importance of eating high-quality food. I do hear you inviting us to consider all the other factors which help to determine whether our meals are truly nourishing. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that. I'm kind of imagining a Mark David bumper sticker that might say something like, eat slowly, chew more, enjoy life.
There you go. I love it.
We've been talking with Mark David, founder and director of the Institute for the Psychology of Eating and author of Nourishing Wisdom. Mark, as I've been listening to you today, I've noticed my belly softening and my heart relaxing and sometimes even a smile uncontrollably passing over my face. It's been a beautiful and I would even say a nourishing experience to absorb your wisdom. We live in a food culture that is so often toxic, frightened, and stressed, and yours is a voice of sanity and wisdom. I want to thank you. We want to thank you for your beautiful work and for sharing such a feast with us today.
Thank you so much, Ocean. Thank you so much, John. I'm such a big fan of the work that you're doing, and it's just an honor to be here with you both.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. This concludes Day 8 of the Food Revolution Summit. Tomorrow will be a little different than all the other days, because instead of 3 presentations, there will be just 1. My dad, John Robbins, and I will be joining forces to deliver a special hour-long send-off to help you put all that we've been learning into delicious and game-changing action. We'll begin tomorrow's presentation at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, and like all the others, it will be available on 24-hour replay from our broadcasts page. We'll be thrilled to have you with us. One of the things I love about food is that it's very social, and we want to have the Food Revolution Summit be social too. That's why we've added a comments area at the bottom of our broadcast page. You can go there to share your reflections, your inspirations, your take-home learnings, whatever you've gotten out of the summit so far, and to engage with the insights and the ideas of others. Remember, you'll need to refresh the page if you want to see the latest comments. And if you want to take the next step with us and take it all home for life, then you may want to take advantage of the summit sale price for your empowerment package. It has been an honor, it has been a joy to share the last 8 days with you, and I cannot wait for our grand finale tomorrow morning. This is Ocean Robbins, signing off for Day 8 and wishing you abundant health and real, nourishing, delicious food.